You're listening to The Berry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning
on KVON.
And it is time now. We are happy to welcome to our studio Dr. Karen Relucio, who's joining us this morning. Dr. Relucio is Napa County's public health officer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the work you do in a time like this. I'm sure you and your staff are under a lot of stress.
Yes, we've been working quite hard. But, you know, I have a great team. I'm really blessed to have a great team and a lot of support.
Mm-hmm. What is the work that goes on that we don't see? We see an announcement now and then, but there's a lot happening, of course. What's happening behind the scenes?
Well, I'll break it down to a few things. So first of all is we have communicable disease investigations that are going on. And so a lot of my communicable diseases staff are dedicated to this response by making sure that they write protocols that are consistent with CDC guidance. They train other nurses on this guidance. They also provide guidance to healthcare providers so that people that they can test patients that they suspect might have COVID-19 based on travel history or exposure. I think the other thing that happens is some of my staff are really allocated to help with the public messaging that goes out, whether it's by website or, you know, other guidance that goes to schools or the public. And then another part of this is, you know, I have a component of public health that deals with emergency medical services. So they make sure that they write protocols that ensure that our pre-hospital EMS providers are, they protect themselves from exposure should they transport a patient by ambulance to a healthcare facility. And then I have other staff that are involved in the emergency response. So, the you know, in coordination with Office of Emergency Services at the county. So we work together in concert. We actually are like partners in ensuring that our emergency response is coordinated throughout this event.
All right. So I guess the question on most people's minds locally, having seen cases in Solano County, cases in Sonoma County, Contra Costa, a bunch of new cases now, so on, there have been no reported cases in Napa County to date, correct?
That's correct. No Napa County residents have been diagnosed with COVID-19. I know that I'm going to address one area, however. There have been United States repatriates that came from the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which is off the coast of Japan, where there was a high attack rate of the virus infection there. And we, you know, did accept a couple patients into the hospital, into Queen of the Valley Medical Center, where those patients were taken care of. But they were also taken care of under really strict infection control protocols. And they were transported in a way that was very controlled to minimize exposure to staff and to the public. So, and I think that the Queen of the Valley has really proven itself in making sure that, you know, they're, that other healthcare workers are not infected because so far none of them have been. Mm-hmm. So this makes, this really ensures that they're prepared should we start seeing cases in the community.
And what is your expectation about seeing cases here?
I think it's not a matter of if we see cases in the community, it's a matter of when. You know, I think that I do want to describe what's in the toolbox for preventing COVID-19. We do not have a vaccine, and we do not have a medicine that is approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Right now, they're under clinical trials. So we are missing that from our toolbox. But we have other areas in the toolbox that we can address. First is prevention. First is making sure that people minimize their exposures because COVID-19 looks like the flu, looks like influenza. And it just so happens that we are having quite an influenza season this year. So I think it's just ensuring that people, you know, wash their hands frequently, use proper respiratory hygiene, stay home while they're sick. If somebody else is sick, stay away from them. So all the hygiene measures as one of our toolbox. The second is disease containment. So disease containment is making sure that you have good surveillance of respiratory illness and that you're able to identify cases and to do really effective contact tracing. And the way that you prevent the spread of disease is by isolating cases or ill people, and then you quarantine those exposed. So there's a difference between isolation and quarantine. So we use those tools at our disposal to make sure that we restrict their movement so they don't spread disease to others. The third part, which communities with community spread are using, is community mitigation or social distancing strategies. So all the disease containment and prevention does is it slows down the introduction of virus to the community, but it doesn't stop it. So then the third phase, which some of our counties are using, such as San Francisco and Santa Clara County, because there's community spread, is social distancing strategies. So it may be canceling non-essential large gatherings, or it may be school dismissals. So those are some of the other areas in our toolbox.
Mm-hmm. In terms of what we might expect in the future in Napa County, the measures you just mentioned in San Francisco and other locations, Santa Clara County has a lot of cases. Is there any reason to expect that if you do see an outbreak in Napa County that the measures would be any different?
Yes. So disease containment measures, meaning isolation and quarantine, become difficult to enforce. So if a health officer writes an isolation or quarantine order for a small amount of people, that's enforceable by law enforcement should that be broken. However, as the cases increase, it takes manpower to actually enforce it, and it gets to the point where it's no longer effective. So then the measures change to larger community mitigation strategies, and those strategies could be quite disruptive socially. So I think the most important part at this time is that people need to be prepared. Because you know the introduction of community spread of disease is going to cause more absenteeism. If a school should be dismissed because there's a case of COVID-19 in the school, that'll be disruptive because parents are going to have to stay home to take care of their kids. Depending on these strategies, it could actually, stop the flow of essential supplies. So preparedness is key here.
Yeah. Let's talk for just a moment about the disease itself and the impact of it. There's a certain strain of thinking, not to use the wrong term, there's a strain of thinking going around, that we're overreacting to this because it's just like a common cold. And most people will have it, get over it without any major effects. Why are we making such a big deal? Can you address that perspective?
Certainly. So in the largest studies that we've been able to see are in China, where there was a WHO impact report that was also published, and I can't remember which medical journal it was, where they looked at about 45,000 patients. And 80% of patients recovered from their illness. They either had mild to moderate disease, and when I mean moderate disease, they developed pneumonia, but they recovered. There are 20% that went on to develop severe disease requiring hospitalization. And then of those that developed severe disease, about 6% of them went on to have critical illness. Where they were on a ventilator, and then those people are more likely to die from the illness when they develop critical illness. So this is, when we look at the severity of illness from this disease, it's not as serious as SARS. So you may remember in the early 2000s, there was a severe acute respiratory syndrome also caused by a coronavirus, which started in China, and there were 8,000 cases with 10% people dying from it. And then there's another coronavirus, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, which, you know, hasn't had as many cases, but there's a 35% mortality rate. So it's a much more deadly virus. So if we were to look at severity of illness of COVID-19, it's more deadly than seasonal influenza, most likely, but it ranges anywhere from seasonal influenza to possibly 1918 flu, but it's too early to tell.
Right.
Because as the denominator gets bigger, the case fatality rate goes down. Mm-hmm. So right now, it's too early to say what the true fatality rate is. It's going to be, we will know that at the end of the epidemic.
Yeah, right.
So I think that what's really important is that the people that were most likely to die from illness are people over 60 and those with underlying medical problems.
And what actually gets you with this kind of illness, not unlike the flu, if I'm right, is the pneumonia. It's not the virus itself. The virus sets you up to get pneumonia, and then that's what drags you down.
That's correct.
Yeah. Is there anything a person can do, particularly in that higher risk category, specifically other than the social distancing, which we'll talk about some more, but in terms of diet, exercise, and so on, any thoughts about that?
Well, for preventing the acute illness, I think that people that are in general healthier, have healthier lifestyles, are less likely to develop chronic medical conditions that could be that can make one vulnerable to this illness. But that's kind of a long-term strategy. I wouldn't say it's short-term. Mm-hmm. I think the most important part are just stepping up the hygiene game, you know, more frequent hand washing, avoiding exposure to those who are sick, and you know, essentially, people that are at risk of developing severe illness, which are people 60 plus, and those with underlying medical conditions, should avoid crowded gatherings because they're more likely to get ill with this.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. Karen Relucio. She is Napa County's health officer. The focus, of course, is on the coronavirus story and the Napa situation. As we mentioned, we still have no cases in Napa County. Two people were treated in Napa County, but they didn't contract it here. And that's important to, you know, keep distinct. When we get into this communicability issue, at first we were hearing that this was a virus that spread very easily, that it wasn't as contagious as measles, but maybe it was more contagious than a common cold or flu. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is definitely accurate. So if we look at infectiousness, measles is the most infectious, virus out there. So there's a reproduction rate or an index of how easily it's spread called the R-naught. It's R and then there's a zero, you know, down mm-hmm. below. It's mm-hmm. like a subscript. And N-A-U-G-H-T is what R-naught. And so the R-naught of measles is 12 to 15. If you go to, the common cold, it's less than one. Right now, the coronavirus, the COVID-19 is anywhere from 2 to 3. So it's definitely more infectious than seasonal flu, much less infectious than measles. I think what makes the R not higher is the fact that a lot of the people in the world have not had an immune, you know, they've not been challenged immunologically by this virus. So our immune systems are naive to this virus, and that's what increases its spreadability.
Mm-hmm. What have you read about the reinfection potential? We saw some stories in that regard in China, particularly, where it's been a longer spell of time where people seem to get over it and then develop it again. Is there enough there to work with?
Yeah, I think there's going to be I think there's more data that needs to be gathered for that. What we do see. What we do see is that sometimes people who are infected with COVID-19, do serial consecutive tests. Mm-hmm. And some people will clear the virus, and then there are others where they might they might not have virus that's detectable in the genetic material. The virus is not detectable by testing, but then it shows up again. And I think what we don't know about detecting that genetic material is it from an alive virus or is it from a dead virus? Because you can detect genetic material from something that's dead. So I think there's more that has to be determined there.
What's the conversation among people who do the work that you do about this whole test kit and testing capacity issue? Yeah. Heard an awful lot about that.
Yes, that's a great question. So, you know, I think that right now the testing capacity is increasing, but it's still not enough. A lot of the testing before was done at the CDC. So then it really restricted who you could test. The criteria were really strict. Now we are getting more test kits that are going to public health labs, first with the state public health lab through the California Department of Public Health, and then now to local public health labs that are throughout the state of California. So, you know, there's 11 to 14 public health labs that now have the capability to test for COVID-19. That being said, that means 5,000 tests, but that's not enough. Because if you were to do a back-of-the-napkin calculation of the people that suffer from an influenza-like illness in California, with, you know, very populous state, we estimate there may be 1 million people with influenza-like illness and up to 3 million people with an upper respiratory illness at one time. So I think that, but this week we should be seeing commercial labs such as Quest or LabCorp, and then in the academic medical centers, they're going to have the capacity to test.
Yeah, that's going to jump up real rapidly, they say.
Yes.
Yeah, the testing capacity. I'm a little worried when something like this comes along. There are unscrupulous people, particularly when something is affecting the older population, who are going to say, this will keep you from getting it, or will cure you if you get it. One thing we've already heard is drinking bleach, which has been going around for, you know, that's been a thing for a while. There's this cult of people that think you can drink bleach and it'll make you better. I just want to be real clear. There is nothing, there's no drug for this of any kind. Anybody who would promote to you that they've got a cure for coronavirus is scamming you at this point, right?
I would definitely say that.
Yeah. So let's all keep that in mind. And then talk about the part of what we can actually do, this whole social distancing and the cleanliness factor. I heard another radio station saying that the when you sneeze or cough, it's about a 6-foot radius. Is that accurate, that your particles that are shooting out of your face are about 6 feet maximum?
I would say that's accurate, and you're talking about millions of viral particles. Mm-hmm. So the basically, when you sneeze or cough, there's a droplet cloud, and then it's full of virus. And so that's
such
really
an ugly picture, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I think that, so, you know, first of all, covering your cough or sneeze is important. But I think the other thing that's really important is how you cover that. If you cough into your hands, all you're going to do is touch something else and then contaminate the surface of the table or anything you touch, doorknobs, you know, your telephone, your keyboard, your light switch. The best thing to do is to cough into a tissue, but not everybody carries a tissue in their hand. So the next best thing is to sneeze or cough into the crook of the elbow. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the best way if you don't have a tissue. Mm-hmm. And then right after you know, if you have a tissue, of course you have to perform hand hygiene. You know, wash your hands or else use alcohol-based hand sanitizer, of which there is a shortage.
Right. But you can make your own at home.
Yes, but I was really curious about this because I was watching a few YouTube videos on how you make that, and all the supplies that are used to make it are also
in short supply. Yeah, 60% alcohol is the key, because at first we were saying, well, get some vodka. Well, most of it is not 60%, so you got to go for a harder liquor than that. In terms of the social avoidance, are we at a point now where you, as the health officer in Napa County, are making any recommendations to people about not going places?
Yeah, You know, I think I'm definitely making recommendations not to go to places that have a travel advisory.
Okay.
And a lot of it is because, you know, there, it's a possibility there may be restrictions on coming back, and you don't want to end up being quarantined when you get back. So I would highly recommend that. However, I think it's a matter of keeping an eye on a CDC's website and looking at their travel advisory. I would say right now it might not be a great idea to travel internationally, mainly because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of viral spread, and we don't know, you know, it could change, you know, the number of countries that are under a level two or level three advisory could change tomorrow.
Yeah. But at this time, there's no issued restriction on doing all the things we normally do, going to the farmer's market, going to a movie, grocery store, sporting event here in Napa. You're not concerned about that at this point?
Not at this time. However, if we are, if you know, we start seeing community transmission of cases, that strategy may change.
Right.
I think that, you know, I think that early application of these social distancing strategies actually diminish the spread of a virus. And I think where we've seen this is in the 1918 influenza pandemic. So I call it the tale of two cities. So you have two cities. One is Philadelphia, and the other one is St. Louis. Philadelphia decided to have their parade. And what ended up happening is they had five times the mortality from the influenza pandemic than St. Louis, who implemented these measures early. So although there may be concerns from others that this is overreacting, or that it could be hurtful to the economy, just think of what would happen if you didn't and you had a lot of people dying from it. That could definitely hurt the economy,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, for sure. Is it accurate to think, and because the 1918 flu pandemic was is cited a lot in the conversations around this, there were no such things as vaccines then, and the development process that we have now, and it makes you start to wonder, could we really ever have that kind of an outbreak, at least around something like a coronavirus, something completely new and different we didn't know how to deal with? That would be one story. This is a kind of somewhat familiar, right? So, I mean, what is the actual potential for that kind of 1918 scenario now?
It's really hard to say. I mean, we've seen, I think that viruses that are a lot more virulent, they cause more death, but they tend to burn out faster. So if you think about MERS or H5N1, when
right.
it was, you know, the bird flu,
right.
Or Ebola, I mean, there were epidemics, but I think that there was just a lot of, you know, when the virus kills the host, then it decreases the effectiveness of transmission to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we are in an advantage in terms of having, you know, knowing more about the transmission of disease and having the measures to prevent spread. And I think also vaccine development has become faster because of, you know, just the breakthroughs in technology. So it's estimated that we may have a vaccine for coronavirus in 12 to 18 months. And that's for a virus where we have not had to have a vaccine before. You know, I think back on the 2009 H1N1, there was vaccine available in 6 months. So I think that'll definitely help.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, since we don't have that available now, we have to stick to the social distancing strategies and infection control.
So wash your hands a lot and well, using soap and water, and have your hand sanitizer if you can get some.
Yes.
And the other thing, you're not supposed to do what I've been doing the entire time we've been talking, which is touching my face.
Yes.
Right? Sitting here with my chin in my hand. I can't stop, so I guess I'm just going to die.
You know what? It is the hardest thing to do.
It's impossible.
And they say you touch your face 20 times an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have just noticed, I have a habit of touching my face too, and you know, it's almost like you need, you know how you have an indicator that counts your steps. You need something that counts how many times you touch your face.
I've got an even better idea. You know, like when dogs have a skin issue and they put those cones on their face? That's what we all need.
Yes.
Big cone.
A big cone.
Every time you reach up, you hit the cone. All right, I'm going to put those on the market later today. They'll be sold out real fast. Dr. Karen Relluccio, thank you so much for taking time to come in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Great information, which we will rebroadcast and relay. And please use us as a conduit to get the word out on anything you need. Okay?
Thank you.
Keep it right here. More from the Berry Pod coming up
on KVON.